You're listening to Holocaust survivor Mel Fedderbusch, interviewed by his son on the occasion of his 90th birthday. Mr. Fedderbusch spent much of his adult life not speaking about his horrific experiences in order to safeguard the feelings of his family. Today, after having 5 grandchildren, he has agreed to reveal the details they've never heard. On this broadcast, Mr. Fedderbusch discusses the concentration camps and death camps at Buchenwald, Triglitz, and Theresienstadt. He reveals details about living in the Polish ghettos and working as a slave laborer for the Nazis. He shares his harrowing experience of being falsely arrested and placed in solitary confinement, and his personal account of the murder of his parents and 9-year-old twin sisters, plus his heroic attempt to save his own life by leaping from a Nazi cattle car headed for the infamous death camp Auschwitz. If you have a question for Melvin Fedderbusch, call us now at 661-349-TALK, 661-349-8255. Or you can participate by joining the conversation in the chat room. Visit talkradiox.com/chat. You may also email your questions to melsurvived@aol.com at any time during the broadcast. To learn more, Mr. Fedderbusch's testimony and original Buchenwald passport can be viewed at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York. His eyewitness accounts can be accessed in the Fortunoff Archives at Yale University and at the Shoah Visual History Foundation, founded by Steven Spielberg. He's a speaker with the Holocaust and Human Rights Education Center in Purchase, New York, where he visits high school students, bringing his message of perpetual hope, global peace, and the end of prejudice. He's an adamant proponent of patriotism for the United States of America and support for her ally in freedom, liberty, and democracy, the State of Israel. This unprecedented live global broadcast is brought to you by TalkRadioX.com. And now, here's your host, Greg Fedderbusch.
Welcome to the show. We have a very special event planned today where I'm going to speak with my dad over a long period of time, maybe way too long, unless you're interested in hearing stories of the Holocaust. And Dad is in New York. Are you there, Dad?
Yes, I can hear you.
And I'm in California, and we're on Skype. So if you have any questions, if someone out there is listening and has questions for him, they can call in anytime during the broadcast at 661-349-8255 or go to the chat room, which is talkradiox.com/chat, talkradiox.com/chat, where my beautiful wife Stephanie is in there.
Hello.
And she will moderate your conversations. If you have any questions, you can ask them on there, or you can email them right now or anytime during the broadcast to melsurvived@aol.com. My dad's name is Mel Fedderbusch. His name is actually Menachem Mendel. And we're going to start off with this whole thing by asking. We also have questions that were submitted by students. Many of these students are asked the same type of questions over and over again. So they're very concerned with certain aspects of your experience, Dad. As you know, because you speak at high schools in New York as a speaker from the Holocaust Education Center in Purchase. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Aren't you going to one of those this week?
Yes, I'm going. In fact, I was on yesterday. I was talking to 17 teachers at New Rochelle High School.
Oh, you were talking. You were talking specifically with teachers, not students.
No, yesterday was with teachers, but tomorrow I'm going to Pace University to talk to students. There.
Did you pass out? What just happened?
Did you hit your head?
My glass fell down on the floor, on the table.
Okay. And is it okay? There's no fire or anything?
No, it's okay. Don't worry about it.
Are you drowning?
No, it's okay.
Okay.
I want to say I'm very happy to do this with my son that assures me, and which is the wish of every Holocaust survivor, that the legacy will continue. I appreciate this very much. Thank you, Greg.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, because you know, it's also important for me to have your experiences recorded for my children and for their children.
Well, that's just what I mean. Yes.
Stop moving.
That's what I mean by the legacy.
All right, please stop moving the microphone around or whatever you're kibitzing around with over there.
Okay.
All right. Because it's annoying. Okay, so here we go. Let's start off with we're gonna basically start off with questions from before the war. I have a teacher contacted me from the New Community Jewish High School. Her name is Beverly Kamenier. She's had some of her students write some of these questions as well. So I'm basically gonna, you know, I'm gonna throw in these questions along the way, but I really also want to hear the answers to my specific questions, because I also have a lot of questions. And then I think what we'll do is we'll go, once we get through your childhood, we'll get into what happened during the war, and we'll use the timeline of the war to figure out how that corresponds to your specific experiences and what you saw during that same time.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's start out with, what is your earliest memory as a child?
As a child? It's a sad story. I remember we rented a forest for the summer, something similar to what we do here, going to a camp or going to for the summer somewhere. And there was a fire in the barn near where we lived or slept. It was happened to be during the night, and everybody got out of the barn. And everybody was safe, but my father thought I was still in there, so he ran in and he tried to save me. I was out, and he got burned very badly, and he almost did not survive.
So you were on vacation?
When I was about 5 years old.
Oh, you were only 5 years old?
At that time, 5 or 6 years old, yes.
And where exactly were you on this vacation? Do you remember the town?
No, it was only a short ride from where we lived. We lived in Dublin, and this was a village somewhere within 20 miles or so of my hometown.
So, and you don't remember the name of it?
No.
Do you remember who you went there with, or do you know who?
I was there only with my family. My father came there only for weekends. And it happened to happen on Saturday night.
How did the fire happen? Do you know?
I think it's from lightning.
Oh, really? There was a storm?
Yeah. It was lightning.
And so you were born in 23, so this was around 1927?
Something like that. Yeah.
And where were you? Do you remember him coming out with a burn?
No, I remember that he was being treated, and it was very bad. I knew what was going on, and he was burned to such a degree that he almost died. He almost died, really, but he luckily came out alive, and it was okay, except it was shown on his face somewhat and on his hands. This is my earliest recollection that I remember.
Did he say anything to you about it ever?
Oh, well, we talked about it occasionally. Yes.
Do you think did he blame you for that or anything?
No, God forbid. No.
I'm just asking. I don't know, you know, what went on.
No, he wouldn't blame. Are you kidding? No, he wouldn't blame me.
So do you remember, so what actually do you remember from that day, or do you remember talking about it, or do you remember when it actually, do you remember the actual fire?
I remember the fire, yes. I remember running out with everybody. And I remember all that, yes. I remember very well.
That's a scary memory for a five-year-old.
Yeah, well, I overcame.
Well, yeah, we'll get into that. You overcame a lot of things.
Right.
So the next question I have, is there anything else about that that you want to add?
No.
Okay, so the next question I have in general is, what was life like for you, you know, when you were a kid?
Life was very, very nice as a kid. Then when I started learning and seeing what was going on, I understood that there were a lot of problems, always, you know. And because I was a kid and I understood, that was possibly... That made it a little bit more difficult for me to, and I was worried about things at times because I understood the problems.
At what age are you talking about?
I'm talking about problems we had. I remember when my father had a few workers, and they made a strike, not just for us. They generally striked. A union, like this was a union. They striked, and one of the workers threw a stone into my window when I was, and he almost hit me. I was in bed. The stone fell into the bed where I slept, and this is basically. But otherwise, my childhood was very nice.
So I didn't recall that story. Now, was that anti-Semitism, or was that a more of a
no? This was not. This was some Jewish workers.
Okay. So, what year was that? Are you talking about?
I'm talking about. It must have been 7 years old or so.
Okay. So around 1930.
Yeah.
So in other words, so what was it that you said you were starting to become aware of that made you worry?
I became aware of that people have problems. You know, union. You know, as a 7 year old, usually you don't think of unions. I did. Because of that thing, I always liked the workers. As a matter of fact, I once went to Warsaw on my own. They had in Poland for kids for 25 cents, you could go anywhere as long as you had an adult sponsoring you, and you went with him. So my mother happened to be in a hospital in Warsaw. And my father didn't know how to cook. So I said to my father, let me go to my aunt, visit my aunt in a town somewhere between Warsaw and my town. That's where she lived. But when I got to the station, I saw a little girl from my school, and she's telling me she's going to Warsaw. And I told her I'm going to Garwolin, which is a different town, not Warsaw. So she was trying to make fun of me because she felt she's going to a big town and I'm going to a small town. So I said, but my lady who was sponsoring me was going to Warsaw, was visiting with her husband who was in a hospital. So I said, wait a minute, I'm going to Warsaw if that's the case. So I didn't say anything and I stayed on the train. We passed the town that I was supposed to leave, and I landed in Warsaw. Now, in Warsaw, the lady says, where is your mother? I said, she is in such and such address I gave her. She took me to that address. That address didn't even exist. So I stayed with people, her relatives, and they were manufacturers, luggage manufacturers, and I stayed with the workers, and they liked me.
Wait a minute. Okay, there's a lot of information here. First of all, why was your mother in the hospital?
She had an ear problem. She had an ear problem. She punctuated her ear.
How?
Something. I don't know, but something. And she had to go to fix that. The only hospital, the nearest hospital was Warsaw. So that's where she went.
But wait a minute. You said she went to Garwolin.
No, she went to Warsaw. I wanted to visit Garwolin, my aunt.
Oh, you were supposed to go to
Garwolin. My father did not know how to cook.
Right, so which aunt?
Wasn't really.
Which aunt was it that you were going to visit?
Well, she was the third youngest sister of my mother. They were four sisters.
Your mother's four sisters. What were their names?
The name.
If you can't remember now, that's fine. We can go back later. But if you can,
I'm sorry, what did you say, Greg?
If you can remember their names, fine. If not, we'll get them later.
Well, I can, but it's going to take me a while to, you know.
All right, so we'll...
might as well go on.
Okay, so your mother's four sisters. It was one of the sisters, the youngest sister.
Yes.
And she lived, and how far away was Garvaline from where you lived?
It was midway, so it must have been like 50 kilometers. It's 100 kilometers to Warsaw, this must have been like 50 kilometers.
Uh-huh. So, and then in Warsaw, who did you see, and how did you know they were there?
Well, she came to visit her husband in the hospital. He had a problem.
Right.
He was in the hospital. But she dropped me off with her relatives because she could not take me to the hospital for whatever reason.
Right.
So her relatives were manufacturers of luggage, and they had a few workers there.
Oh, I see.
And they liked me, so they sent me down to buy lunch for them and drinks and so on. And I slept over with one of them. He took me to some kind of a show to see, and I spent a few days in Warsaw.
Do you remember the show?
No, yes. No. No, but they liked me a lot. I liked them. I always liked workers for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe because I sympathized with them.
So in the meantime, your dad is back in your hometown, and he assumes that you're staying with your aunt.
Exactly.
And how long did you stay away for?
I must have been a week. And then when I came home, so he asked me, my father, How is your mother? How is she doing in the hospital? No, I'm sorry. How's your aunt?
Right.
How's your aunt? I said, I wasn't visit. I didn't see her. What did you do? Where were you? I was in Warsaw. Huh. You know?
And
it just shows how independent you were compared to our kids nowadays.
Yes, because, I was very independent.
I mean, you go on trains, you travel by yourself. Our son doesn't cross the street alone.
Across the street? He's not even allowed in the front yard.
That's true. And you're like in other countries and traveling and staying with people you don't know.
I was trying to go to Palestine. We went to see to say goodbye to someone who was going to Palestine at that time. At that time, Israel was not an independent country like today. It was called Palestine, and it was and some friends of ours who went to Israel, the whole family went, and we went to say goodbye to the train. And I envied them so much. I wanted to go there, so I was hiding under a bench, ready to go to Israel.
What year was this?
This was somewhere along the line. I must have been about 11 years old or so.
So around 1934.
34, right.
So who was it that was leaving? It was a friend?
Friends, yes.
Uh-huh. In your lifetime as you were growing up, there were people leaving to go to the land of Israel?
Oh, sure. Not too many, unfortunately. A lot of them would have liked to go, but they couldn't afford it, and it wasn't possible because the British had policies such against that they made it very difficult for Jews to go to travel to Israel or to settle in Palestine.
So you had to get sort of a visa or something?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I remember my father, we wanted to go to Palestine also. This was a year before the war broke out.
1938.
And we could only go as a capitalist, which entails you have to show that you have $5,000. At that time, a capitalist, if you had $5,000, you were considered a capitalist, and with that, you were able to go to Israel.
Because they wanted you to invest the money there?
I know. They didn't want anybody to be dependent
on the state, on the British government.
On the government or whatever, you know. But that's what the policy, only to make it difficult because the Arabs, they had a lot of pull, and they... This is why, and they wanted to be friends with the Arabs because of the oil, you know, and that's how it, that's why they made it difficult for the Jews.
So you knew about that. So when did you begin to know? When did you first decide that you felt like you wanted to go to Israel? Was it more about just wanting to be an explorer and go places?
No. I belonged to a Zionist organization since I was like 10 years old. That organization is still in existence today. The leader was Jabotinsky, and our hero was Trumpeldor. And I know all about this in detail.
What's the name of the organization?
Beitar, or uh-huh. Revisionists.
And
today they call themselves the Likud Party.
Uh-huh.
They are in power today in Israel.
In the government.
Netanyahu is one of those, belongs to that party.
Now, how did you get involved with that, and who introduced you to that?
They solicited elderly people also. Like my father also was a member. But they had a youth group and they had grown-ups, and my father was and I joined the youth group, and I must have been I don't know why they chose me to talk about our hero Trumpeldor on a Saturday afternoon to all of the members. Young and old. And I still remember that story.
You told a story?
Yes, they told the biography of Trumpeldor, our hero.
How did you know the story?
They taught me the story.
they drilled it into your head and then made you repeat it in front of a whole group.
They wanted me to talk to everybody about the story. They taught me the story.
Because you were young and they thought it would be more interesting?
I guess so.
And you liked it. Why? How did that make you feel?
I made me feel that I loved Israel, and I wanted to go to loved Palestine. I wanted to go to Palestine very badly. And then, when I was in the United States, the first few years when I got the passport, 5 years after I arrived in the United States, I went on a trip on a business trip to Europe, and at that time we only had the propeller driven airplanes, and we had to stop in Rome. In the meantime, on the airplane, we were singing these Zionist songs that I knew well. There were a lot of young people going to Israel just on a trip, and a lot of them didn't know each other because they came from different organizations and different. Travel agencies, and they thought I'm going to Israel. And I told them I'm not. They were really very disappointed. So I said to myself, geez, I always wanted to go to Israel. Why not? This is a good occasion. But I called up. I was in business. I was already established well in business. This was 5 years after I was in the United States. I called up my manager, and I told him I'm going to Israel for a few days. And he says, go ahead. I'll take care of everything.
All right. We'll get back into that stuff. I don't want to jump ahead too much.
Okay.
So this love of Israel, it sounds to me like it was almost, it wasn't your own choice in a lot of ways. You were introduced to something as a very young child and influenced by the people around you.
Well, but I loved it.
I understand. So, and did your father feel the same way? Did your other siblings feel the same way?
Well, they were younger. They did not, they were not aware of it as much as I. Because they were younger.
We do have a phone call, so let me try and take this and see who would like to join the conversation.
My name is Robert Federman, Federman. I'm in California.
Well, I know you, Mr. Federman. You are a cousin, are you not?
Yes, who are you?
I'm Greg, and I'm your cousin.
Greg Federbush, I know you, and I know Itzik, and I know all about you. We should have talked long ago, but now is the right time.
That is true. You are, let me see if we could figure out how you're related to my father. Dad, are you back?
Yes, I'm back now.
Okay. On the phone is your cousin Bob Federman. Can you hear him?
Oh, yes. Well, I just heard him, yes.
Okay. So let's figure out how you guys are related.
Well, Melvin will tell you, but he told me twice, and I know generally. My grandmother was Feige.
Yes. Your grandmother Feige came here to the United States. According to Maury Silver, may he rest in peace, yes. He told us that Feige, your grandmother, was brought up in the house with my grandfather. With my grandfather,
right.
His name was Moshe Aaron. And they were like sisters and brothers, even though they were only cousins. And
yeah, what happened was my grandmother was married to Moshe Untauglich.
I'm sorry?
Untauglich, yeah.
Untauglich, yes.
Right. Well, the reason what happened was my grandmother was the oldest son of Samuel Isaac Fetterman. One day, Samuel Isaac Fetterman decided he didn't like to be married to Feige's mother, so he left with the oldest son, Louis. My grandmother then lived with your family, and I know that because she told me that.
Right.
And you and I met each other and Cindy when you came to the United States, and I was in New York with my father, Benjamin, and you met him also.
I met Benjamin, your father, and your uncle also.
Leo.
Leo. Yes. From Pittsburgh.
No, Leo was from Cleveland also.
I'm in Cleveland.
In Cleveland. Leo's son, Milton, lives in Florida.
Oh, is that right? Where does he live, do you know?
Miami Beach.
In Miami, okay.
He had an older brother, Samuel, who died. Sam died a few years ago.
So you guys are... what is it? Third cousins, or how do you figure that out?
My father had two brothers. One of them was Leo. Father was the youngest. The older brother was Samuel. Robin Fetterman is Samuel's granddaughter. My father also had five sisters, and your father mentioned Maury Silver. He died recently. His mother, Lily, was one of my father's older sisters.
Right. Yes.
Okay, so you're... So, I know that. So you're cousins.
Well, Milton is my first cousin, as was Maury Silver.
Right. Well, you...
My grandmother had 16 grandchildren.
Oh, my.
Yes.
She had 8 children and 16 grandchildren.
I knew her quite well. I knew her when I came over to the United States. She was still alive, and she died when she was 100 and some years old. These are the rumors. These are the rumors.
Melvin, you knew. Well, nobody knew how old she was. She was born in bed. Melvin, you knew Eli Wilczek.
Of course, I did very well.
Okay, he was I know Eli Wilczek's wife Sylvia was my father's sister.
Right, I know that, and so was Molly.
I'm in touch with Zeke Eisenberg, Molly's son.
Zeke, right. Yes, I know, of course, I know very well. I know the whole family, the whole mishpucha.
Do you remember meeting me?
Of course. What is your name?
Bob. Robert.
Bob, we met in California.
Not only did we meet in California, I was supposed to meet you in Florida, but you were ill.
Right, that's right, exactly, yes.
Well, thanks for calling in. That's really kind of you to connect with us.
All right, no, Mel, tell me one more thing. I know that my grandmother was. I just wondered how they were. I know my grandmother lived with your family, Mel. Would she have been his uncle? Why Fetterbush? Why not Fetterman? Why Fetterbush?
Do you know how the names were changed, Dad, or why they changed to Fetterman?
Yeah, they changed. This was changed here in the United States by what's his name, the one who was very rich, who had the
his name was M.J. Fetterman. He was one of the partners.
Wasn't his name L.G.?
L.G. Fetterman was another one. My grandmother had eight brothers and sisters. There were 9 children that Samuel Isaac Fetterman had.
You're talking to Greg. His is also LG. He's got the same name.
Oh,
LG. Well, they named the name LG. Leo Gibble was named in every generation. There are 8 Leo Fettermans over the last 100 years.
Right.
And so I see. So they changed it to make it sound more Americanized. Yeah.
I'll tell you something even funnier. Samuel Isaac Federman was married four times. He died in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, in the late 1920s, and living with his last and youngest wife. She was younger than his youngest child. They like to make children.
He's like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Well, it was a mitzvah. He was always making mitzvahs.
Good for him. Yes. Okay. See, we're good people, the Federbushes, Federman.
Who is it that died and left a lot of money?
The one who died who left $10 million was M.J. Fetterman. M.J. Fetterman was the wealthiest of all, and as a matter of fact,
Did you get $1,000? Okay.
No, I got 500, but that was in 1948.
Right.
Was he the proprietor of a major corporation?
Yes, he was the founder and largest shareholder of what was known as the Interstate Department Stores.
And they
spawned off the Boston chain stores. He left about $10 million. L.G. Fetterman only left $2 million. He didn't make as much.
Uh-huh.
There's also a Charlie Fetterman whose grandson lives in Florida by the name of Doug.
Yeah.
Did the Interstate Department Stores become a chain that's still in existence today?
Yes, it belongs to Macy's.
In a way. They spun
Doesn't
off
Macy
something
own
called,
it?
No, no.
Macy,
a white
Macy owns it.
Well, they've been out of business for some time. They did spawn a discount store called White Front, and Macy may have acquired that.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Thank you so much, Bob. Great speaking with you.
Greg, let's keep in touch, and know that I wish you the best. Happy birthday, and may you live to be as long as you are healthy and be healthy as long as you can.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. Give my best to your family.
And okay, tell Elsa if she wants to reach me. I did give her my phone number because she did tell Stacy, I guess, that she was looking for us.
Great. Right, give me the number.
No, we have it. He sent it to me. I'll forward it to you. Don't worry about it.
I'm so happy we could talk. I wish you all the best and good health.
Thank you.
Thank you. Listen, keep listening because you're going to hear all the entire story, my life story.
Yeah, if you have enough time.
Right now I'm on a cell phone and I'm sitting in a hospital parking lot.
Oh my. Oh, okay. Goodness gracious. Well, thank you for calling and love to Carol.
Well, thank you for all your good words and good wishes and have a nice day.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.
Keep well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Very good. So give us a call, 661-349-8255, if you're interested in speaking with Mel Federbush, Holocaust survivor, my dad. So let's go on, okay?
Go ahead.
Let's get some information about you. Did you have any special talents as a child? Did you parents recognize anything in you when you were small? I'm talking about small. Let's start with little.
I don't really know. All I know is that I had talent of making money. That's all I wanted to do, was make money.
Did that start at a very young age?
Yes.
How early do you remember that being?
We had a tenant who was a casket maker. He made caskets. And when he sold each casket with a cross and a tablet which said on it, you know, the name of the deceased and the born and the date of birth and the date of when he died.
Right.
And so on. I made those tablets when I was about 12 years old, and I got one zloty for each tablet. I made one a week or something like that.
A zloty?
And that was a lot of money, believe it or not. A zloty, that's the Polish money equivalent to $1. Actually, at that time, the exchange was 5 zlotys to $1. But the zloty in Poland was very valuable.
In other words, it could buy a lot there.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So that was your talent. So we'll get into that a little bit more later. Then tell me about the home that you grew up in. This was in Dublin. Do you remember the address?
Well, we had three addresses in my lifetime in Dublin. The first one I remember, I can't remember the name, the number of the house, but we lived in a house. We were on the second floor, and underneath there was a butcher store. In fact, that butcher store belonged to an uncle of mine, and there were other apartments, very flimsy, made out of wood, two-story building. I remember the stairs that we walked up, and we had three rooms. One was the kitchen, very large, and a small room, and then we had a very large bedroom. And this was that was it. That was pretty good. And then we also have an attic where my mother used to hang the clothes to dry after the wash. She hung up everything up there to dry. Our neighbors also used it.
How did you get up to that attic?
There was a ladder, just a ladder.
So she had to climb up a ladder to dry the clothes?
Yes.
And what age were you in this particular house?
Oh, this was the first. I was very, very young. This was at the same time when my father was after the fire. This was when I was about 4 or 5 years old.
So at that point in time, your brothers and sisters, you only had, your sisters weren't born yet.
No. As a matter of fact, they were born just before we moved out of that house, out of that apartment.
Okay,
yes.
So when
they were born there in 1930, which means in 1930, I was 7 years old already.
Right. So you lived there till you were seven. And where did you guys sleep? You all slept in one room? How did it work?
We all slept in that large bedroom. So the little room that we had, so we rented it out to a woman with a daughter. I remember that. And we all slept in that big, large room.
And during the day, was that a different room during the day?
No. This was the room, the bedroom. There's nothing else was there except, nothing else, just for the bedroom.
And you each have your own?
In the kitchen.
You had your own beds?
We had three beds, and if we needed another one, we just, put up a bed.
So you weren't sharing beds at that point yet?
Yes. I had my two brothers, and we were sharing a bed with my two brothers.
Oh, okay. Was it a large bed or was it not any
larger than a normal size bed.
So how did you guys all fit in one bed?
Well, two guys slept on the one way, and the one guy slept from the bottom up.
Uh-huh, so your feet were in their faces.
Exactly, yes.
Okay. So that was the first house. Yes. Do you remember the address?
No.
Do you remember? So did you have any artwork on the walls? Did you guys listen to music?
No, Greg, this was so simple. But I don't remember anybody having artwork on their walls.
And what did your father do at that time?
He had the same business, manufacturing furniture and in partnership with someone else.
Where did he do that?
He had a place where I did that separately.
Was it far from the house?
No. Everything was so short. The whole thing was everything was within walking distance, no more than five minutes the furthest walk.
The town was small.
It's very small.
It was. Was it considered a shtetl?
Well, you could consider it. It was not a typical shtetl where I knew shtetls like Ricky, where it was all Jews. But we had a mixture of people in our town.
Why was that, do you think?
I know, because we had a lot of military around us. We had the only military airport. Then we had a very large citadel that was that housed a regiment of the 15th, the army.
So this is the Polish army.
Polish, yes.
And the army had an air force base at the airport in your town.
The army airport were two different things. The army was in the citadel. The airport was in a different place.
But it was in your town.
The airport was quite large. It was like larger than the town.
So was this an airport for private people too, or was it a military?
No. It was military only, and it was also a school for pilots. It was a town, a really large, with large buildings and for the military.
So we're going to find out later that the Nazis ended up taking over that
that airport. Exactly.
And so, but at that time, the Polish army was using it to train pilots.
Yeah, the Polish Air Force, not the army.
My mistake. We have on the line your daughter. This is my sister, Tina, who... is the second born to Melvin, and you had two kids, and it's just me and Tina. Go ahead. Do you have a question, or did you just call to disturb your brother?
No, I actually had a question for our father, listening to him talking about where he grew up, where he lived, how life was there. What made him, after all that he dealt with in his life, between being poor as a child and going through the Holocaust, what gave him that drive to succeed, to want more? Why didn't he just give up after all he endured?
Well, are you saying why didn't he give up during the war, or why did?
Most people, when they've endured what he has endured in his life, during the war, let's say, losing his family, why not give up? Why not give up? What made him strive to want more? Because I feel that we lack that in our lives. A lot of people, I don't want to say the word lazy, but the enthusiasm, the drive isn't there.
Well,
and he took a chance.
Don't you think sometimes when you go through some sort of adversity, you have more of a drive? You know, we're so complacent because everything's come so easy to our generation. What do you say, Dad?
Greg, you're right. What you said. I had the drive because in my youth I did not have what I wanted. Didn't even have enough food. I really did not have enough food. So I really wanted, my drive was to have everything when I grow up, and I wanted to have everything for my children, more than I had myself.
Right. So you never feared taking chances, where I feel that a lot of people do fear that in life, is to take a chance. Because you took a chance on building a business that was really more of a luxury than it was a necessity to people, you know? So what gave you that self-confidence to know that what you were doing for a living was going to provide for a family, was going to be successful?
What I wanted, I had nothing to lose. We did not think of risk-taking, being afraid of risk-taking. Uh-huh. We had no such fear. I do not understand. Okay. I did not know fear. Uh-huh. And I beg your pardon?
No. I'm agreeing. So I'm saying that really, because you've lost so much prior in your youth, there really was no such thing as loss for you as an adult. Taking a chance was, in your mind, just being successful, because there was no room for failure.
That's right.
Did you feel like you were taking a chance? You were taking a risk? You were just doing what you wanted to do?
I just went ahead and did everything that I liked to do, and I did. To be specific, when I was in business manufacturing the frames, I designed the frames And the things that I liked myself, first of all, but I also knew what the public would like. I understood that very well. And I did not hesitate to invest whatever it takes in order to produce and invest whatever it takes to make the product. And most of the time, whatever I designed was successful and did sell well. And I made a good profit on everything I did.
Do you feel it was the time, the period of time that made you that success? Do you feel that if somebody started a business like that now, or any sort of business which is more of a luxury item, because that's what your frames were, that they could be as successful if they had your drive and confidence? Because, I mean, you definitely had confidence in your work.
Absolutely.
And you believed in yourself.
Yes.
So do you feel the way the times are now? Because I think for our generation, your grandchildren, it's a little bit more difficult to take a dream and bring it to, you know,
Tina, I feel that America has opportunities now the same way as it offered opportunities to us then. As a matter of fact, then America had lesser standard of living than today. Today, the incomes are much higher than it was then. We had more poor people then than today. Today, even the poor are not really poor, because when you compare the income of a poor man today and the income of a poor man then, it's quite a difference. Then that poor man did not have, when he didn't have money, he just couldn't afford anything. Today, a poor man gets enough money from the government that they not only afford to eat, but also they have enough to pay for rent and for good apartments. Everyone lives in nice apartments, and they're being paid for every child. And it is absolutely, the opportunities because of that, because of people having more money, are much greater than it was then. And then you had to be a real genius. And what I made especially did not sell to the poor. It only sold to the middle income people and the rich people.
Right. And you took a chance. That's the biggest thing.
I took a chance. I did everything that had to be done. I did not hesitate for one second.
And a lack of education. This was all just done on pure talent, right? This wasn't done on a college education.
Well, no, they don't teach you in college these kind of things. No, I did it the old fashioned way. Right. You know.
Which I think nowadays is harder to do. Though we do have more resources, I mean, do you feel that today's youth has that opportunity?
I think that today I would have a greater opportunity to do what I did.
Okay.
Well, that's very also good. Because you know, you probably would have taken more chances if you knew then what you know now, yeah?
Well, at that time, the difference, very simple, is at that time I had to create a market for my product. The product I made was not even available. Today, there is a market for what I did, and so it's easier to sell to people something that they are looking for. I had to sell something to people that they didn't look for it. I had to make a market for it.
Right.
And that is a big difference.
Okay. Right. Anything else?
We're not getting this moment now.
Okay. So feel free to call back if anything pops up.
Will do. Will do. Thank you. Nice listening to this.
Thank you, baby.
All right.
Love Thank you, guys. Tina.
Love you.
I love you.
You're welcome, Daddy. Love you too.
Bye.
Bye.
I am getting another call. From, it's Cousin Felicia.
It's Cousin Felicia.
The whole family's calling in.
Because I'm listening to it at work. Well, I'm trying to work.
How nice of you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Hey, Uncle Melvin.
Hi, Felicia. How are you?
I'm good. I had a question I thought about. I think I heard, maybe from my father, that when you were younger, you were against the war and against what was going on, and you always told your mother to leave, you know, that you should leave, you know, Europe. Was that true?
Yes, that was true, very true. Yes, I always wanted to go to Israel, to Palestine at that time. And if we would have gone to Palestine, my parents and my sisters would have been alive still today. No, maybe not, because my father would have been now over 100 years old, and my mother too. My mother was born in 1905, and my father was born in 1998. Who told you, your father told you that?
I think my father told me that, and I remembered it, and I think I never had a chance to ask you. But I know, because you were, maybe you mentioned it too, you were always reading, you knew what was going on.
Right.
You saw the trouble starting, it happening.
If you heard me before, that I was, even from childhood on, I was a Zionist, belonged to this organization. So
right.
Belonging to this organization meant the love of Israel, an independent country for the Jews. And this is what I always loved. And I loved, and that's why I was looking forward for my father to work out papers and go and emigrate to Palestine, which is today Israel. This is something that I had on my mind since I was about 9 years old. And then when I was about 10, I belonged to this Zionist organization. And I was fully aware.
You should
aware.
Talk about all this. When Gregory comes back on the radio, you should pick that whole piece up again. That was important, because you had the insight to know to leave.
Well, I know to leave. Yes, I did. I always wanted to improve our standard of living. This was very important to me. And my father was very hardworking, very hard, and didn't have the time for all that, but he was aware of it because he belonged to the same organization.
All right, have fun.
Bye, thank you.
Thank you, Felicia.
Love you guys.
Love you,
love
bye.
Love you, bye.
I love you, Felicia.
We were just speaking to Felicia, my cousin, your niece.
Right.
She is the daughter of your only immediate family member who survived the Holocaust. She is the daughter of your brother Sidney, who was named Simcha.
Yes.
And your twin sisters and your parents and your other brother were all perished in the Holocaust, and we'll get to the specifics of that as we go on. Thank you for listening to this chapter of the interview with Mel Fetterbush, Holocaust survivor, on the occasion of his 90th birthday.